All right, we're live. I'm going to play this intro and then we'll kick it right off.
Cool.
Welcome back, horror fans. It is a brand new year full of brand new fears, and we are so glad to have you along for a screaming good time with us. I am your host, JL, and I'd like to welcome all of you out there listening to another episode of our incredibly special Front Row series, where we sit down for a chat with the industry professionals whose dedication and love for all things horror continue to make this the greatest genre of all time. I have the distinct pleasure of sitting down this month with writer, director, and all manner of creative type, James Dean. Welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me, man. I'm excited to be here and talk about, you know, just a little bit of everything, honestly. Yeah.
Hell
we
yeah.
Can easily get sidetracked just discussing horror films, as long as it's not like the more current ones, because like we kind of talked a little bit before we went live, it's hard to keep current sometimes when you're working.
It is. I, as a professional, because you find yourself on set all the time, or you're in the editing suite, or you're writing all the time, it can be hard to stay unless it's like something crazy popular, like, oh my god, Hereditary, you know, and everybody heard about Hereditary.
Right.
But you know, even running a podcast where we talk about movies every single week, it's like every week, four movies, I'm so embroiled in that sometimes even I have to rely on people come, hey, did you hear about this movie coming out? And I had no freaking clue, man. What is that
right
about?
Right.
So yeah, same thing. Yes.
for 2 years, myself and then my buddy, we had a podcast where we just had kind of like this. We just had conversations with indie filmmakers, and it wasn't always horror. I mean, you know, it generally went that direction more often than not. But and it was nice because I made myself every week watch at least one of their films. And I was also watching indie film, which was kind of cool on top of it. But then I was also at least making myself watch a movie a week. And, you know, it is so easy to kind of not have the time to do that when you're juggling five different things. And each one of those things is legitimately a 40 an hour job, you know, like in itself, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
But the killer thing I find is that, and, you know, that's what like I'm telling you, like the reason we created the podcast in the first place is, you know, it's like remembering where we came from, kind of like it's a nostalgia, kind of a nostalgia thing.
Sure.
As well. But I've always found it, you know, as a writer, and I'm sure that you'd agree with this, that your number one best tool as a writer is reading. Is, you know,
yeah,
reading everything you get your hands on. It's like if you read your favorite authors, read authors you never heard of, and that can inspire your own writing and help you to find your own voice and like that. And I find that even as a filmmaker, the same thing, you know, you watch the movies, you know, like, you know, I'll always, you know, love, you know, whatever directors, Carpenter or whatever. And watching those movies helps us to find our own style and maybe even challenge us to try and do new things and be like, oh, maybe I could pull something like that off. Do you have anybody that you kind of like always fall back on? You have those kind of like original inspirations?
I would say, well, I mean, I have favorites just like anybody. The one thing that I can circle back around to that, but the one thing that I absolutely love to do is in the writing process, I love to put music on that will help to kind of keep me in that headspace. You know, if I'm writing, like right now, I'm kind of working on a couple different scripts, and then my writing partner is working on a completely different script. But one of the scripts I'm working on is a giallo. And so, you know,
nice.
I mean, there's so many sources of just amazing music to pull from with that. As far as like favorites that definitely have an influence on me, Raimi, Peter Jackson, like Dead Alive and Evil Dead 2, those two are, and you know, I get it. A lot of people, those aren't their type of movies, but they're right in my wheelhouse. Like, I feel like so many people want to take so many things so serious, and it's life, you know, none of us are getting out of it alive. Let's have a little fun. And I'm not saying that I love, like, I also at the same time love A24 movies. And I love those more serious and dark and heavy films. So I guess it really just depends on what I'm pulling from or what I'm trying to accomplish with the story I'm telling. My go-to is always, like I said, Peter Jackson, Sam Raimi. And then, you know, depending on the story, like those things wouldn't necessarily work great if I'm trying to tell a super serious story or even a giallo, it doesn't necessarily lend itself so much to those two films or those two filmmakers, but there's still always going to be little pieces of them that are going to be used in my storytelling and in my, you know, even my cinematography to an extent, you know?
Right.
And I think what those two in particular, they fully embraced indie film when they were indie filmmakers, and they understood, if I'm going to try something outside of the box, now is the time to do it. You know, there's less to worry about. There's probably less producers, I'm assuming, less producers, you know, breathing down your neck on, you can't do that shot. You can't pour that much blood on someone. You know, I mean, like Bruce Campbell, to get that shot in the cabin, they had to tilt the entire set sideways because they couldn't pump it at him fast enough. They had to literally pull the top off of the barrel and just let gravity do it. Like, I can't imagine if you have $20, $30, $50, $100 million, you know, I can't imagine a whole lot of studios being like, yeah, let's go ahead and freaking basically choke our actor out by having them drown on fake blood, you know, like someone somewhere is probably not going to be too, you know, too into that.
Wild. You just reminded me of a scene, one of my favorite ones, because unlike one of my co-hosts, Johnny O, he's not a huge Nick Cage fan, but I do love Nick Cage and his tireless dedication.
I love Nick Cage. Yeah.
Mandy is one of my absolute favorites. Oh. I love Panos Cosmatos. Love what he brought to that role. And there's a scene when he does that where he cuts the dude's throat, you know, right above him. And it's just like it's like they just dumped it like into his face. And he's just like laughing his ass off the whole time. It was like, that's great.
This is where we quickly go off track. That was I think it was 2018. That was my favorite movie that year. And I would go as far as to say that was my favorite like experience that year. I mean, like, cause like I saw it in a theater and it was at this once a month kind of thing here in St. Louis called Late Night Grindhouse. And so you had that. Yeah. So they play older films mostly, but that was a newer one. It was brand new when it was playing. And you know, to hear that score with those colors and what you're experiencing blaring at you. And I do recommend, if you watch Mandy and you haven't seen it yet, play that stuff as loud as possible, because it is an experience. And I was blown away. And I mean, I love Nick Cage anyway. I, you know, the good, the bad, everything in between. I love Nick Cage. So like, it was just kind of a combination of all these awesome little things that makes James James and what I like, and it's like, yes, give me more of this.
I gotta ask. Okay, so this is actually a funny inside joke, since we broke ground on the movie Mandy. It's arguably one of my favorite. Yeah, him, that and Color Out of Space will get me every time. But in Mandy, I gotta ask, did you pick up at all on the Greek tragedy underlying the entire story?
Yeah,
and the Greek illusions. That red is Jupiter and Mandy is Rhea, so on and so forth.
I think at the time I went back and read just everything I could find on it. So I remember reading about a lot of that. I don't think when I saw it, I think I saw it in theaters twice and then I bought it immediately. But I don't think I picked up on it, you know, at first. But after reading about it and then rewatching it, I was like, oh, okay. Like, you can kind of see the, yeah, for sure.
I love Panos Cosmatos. His dad, not so much, but that's neither here nor there. But Panos does a magnificent job. Thought he was brilliant. And of course, if you haven't had an opportunity on Netflix, he directed one of the shorts in Del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities.
Oh, okay.
And his short in that has fucking Peter Weller in it. Eric Andre doing a dramatic performance, if you can believe that shit.
Oh, wow.
It is bonkers amazing. So I strongly recommend if you get an opportunity to watch that.
Talk about someone that has just a fantastic, amazing Del Toro. Again, being an indie filmmaker, it's hard to draw inspiration, not to draw inspiration, but to act on that inspiration when you're talking about Del Toro, because his frames are so well crafted, and the art design and just everything put into it just really comes down to, you need a lot of money, you know, or at least you need a lot of resources somehow. You need a lot of people to help you design and craft that frame. If you're going to tell more than one location, you know, his frames are so beautifully done, and his storytelling and just everything about it. Del Toro is just, Yeah,
going all the way back to Devil's Backbone, Devil's Backbone, and Kronos, one of my favorite vampire flicks of all time. Fucking love Kronos. And not to mention, that's why, you know, given I kind of grew up with it, you know, and loved everything that he's ever done, especially even the fish sex movie. But I'm really looking forward to his take on Frankenstein. That's going to be I think it's going to be next level. So
I'm gonna tell you something. I'm not a huge fan of anyone like retelling that story. The Bride of Frankenstein is one of my favorite horror films of all time. It is so tragic and so beautiful and just so horrible, you know. And you know, I feel like Del Toro can do it. You know, I feel like he can do it. It's not going to be the same for so many reasons, but I feel like he also has his finger on the pulse of like social, what's going on socially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the fact that Frankenstein was written by, you know, a woman, and then it was also, you know, directed by a gay man in the 30s. Yeah. You know, these are all things that, you know, I can't bring that experience. Del Toro, I don't think, can bring that experience, but he has his own thing he can bring. So I'm okay with it. You know, it'll probably take on a slightly different meaning, and I have to be open to it. But he's probably the only director, and I mean, not even my favorites would I want to see direct a Frankenstein film, to be honest with you. He's probably the only one that I would be okay with. Not that anyone's calling me and asking me for permission, but I'm just saying. I'm just saying he's probably the only one. Yeah.
Oh man, I'm definitely going to be excited. I'm excited about it. So going into your filmography and the work that you've done, before we dive into Fontaine, before we dive into Triple Xmas, which both I had a chance to sit down and watch, and you know, we're gonna get there. But given your style and the love that you have for I would say pretty much the entire, you say grindhouse, but the entire exploitation oeuvre, that whole span of it. And when you first came in, when you first got into it, like your origins, how you kind of came into being a filmmaker, not just as like, I want to put stories to film, but also the style that you have. How did that, what was that process coming up to that?
Right. So I think it's important to note that I always wanted to be a filmmaker. I always wanted to tell stories, but I really never pursued it for tons of different reasons. And we can skip past most of that because it's probably the same thing you've heard from most people. You know, they didn't have a supportive background. You know, there's no money in it, blah, 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 whatever. So I didn't touch a camera myself until I was 35. I'm 43 now. But and then I started learning the process a little bit of just a little bit of cinematography, this and that. And I know that I knew that I loved, you know, B films and exploitation films, grindhouse. I just love film in general. Like, to me, if I'm going to pick one medium of art, it is film for sure. It'll always be film. And when I was younger, I don't think that I would have felt comfortable arguing in favor of film as being an art form. And now I would, there's very few things I would argue with anyone about, but that's probably, I mean, honestly, most time I don't care. If you have your opinion, I'll have my opinion. It's fine. We can disagree. But I think, I know that not only is film an amazing art form, but it's my favorite, and it's just fantastic. I don't know. It's like watching magic unfold, you know?
Right.
And I've used that example before, but it really is. And it's not just magic when you're watching it as a consumer, because that's kind of where everything has led, is now we're all just consumers. We're just consuming content day in and day out. But even on set, when I'm watching it and I've put in all the work, and not just me, but everyone else that's put in tons of work, because it's not just me putting in all that work. And then watching it unfold, and then, you know, I edit my own films, so cutting them together, it's all magic. To me, it's still magic, you know? And it's just, it takes on a little bit different feel. But sorry, I'm kind of getting a little sidetracked. You were talking about like the feel and the aesthetic. I think it's going to continue to develop and change. I don't want to feel locked down into one look or one type of film. The film that we shot before Triple Xmas was actually called Absolution, and it'll be the next one that comes out. And when people see that, they're going to think probably that I took a major shift away from exploitation, you know, nudity and all that. And then they're not going to realize that it was actually shot. And I wrote that one all by myself. And that was all done before Triple Xmas. And then I returned back to the splat stick over the top. And there is some, there is a little bit of being grounded in Triple Xmas. There's a few characters that help ground it a little bit, you know, but a lot of it's over the top and ridiculous, you know, and that's okay with me. But I love being able to play in all these different sandboxes. I don't want to feel contained to one type of storytelling or one thing. I have an idea for a comedy drama, you know, like, you know, maybe it'll happen one day, maybe it won't, but I don't want to feel like I'm only allowed to tell one story, you know?
Right. That's awesome. And yes, okay, so that's interesting, because that's information that I didn't actually have, that Absolution was actually came before Triple Xmas did. Yeah. And so that, because I thought, because from the information that I found, it hadn't been released yet, so I thought it was coming on the heels.
Sure.
So that makes sense.
It's a much heavier film. It's about an alcoholic Vietnam veteran who, I mean, you know, he's in his 70s, where, you know, it's present day, and he discovers someone that was sexually assaulted, and he helps her, he stitches her back up, and it kind of starts there. It's like, I don't know if you've ever seen Blue Ruin.
Yes.
So I absolutely love that movie. So it's 75% Blue Ruin, and okay, I lied a little bit. It's like 25% Death Wish 3, okay? There's a little bit of exploitation in there. I'm not going to completely. But it is definitely much more subtle, and it's not as in. There's a couple moments where there's some lines where I had him really push it, like, you know, the lead actor in it. Just because, you know, like, let's have it both ways. Maybe in the edit, maybe I want to push it a little. Maybe I want to lean into that exploitation a little bit right here. Maybe the audience wants that, you know, like, but yeah, I don't want to stick to just one thing. I want to do a lot of things, and I absolutely love, like, it excites me to get back on set with people that I've worked with before. Nice. And the same will be true, like, with the people that I worked with on Triple Xmas. I hope to have them back, and not only back, but I want to see them all in completely different characters and roles, and ideally stuff that they normally don't get to do, because then they get to grow as an artist and I get to grow as an artist. And, you know, I mean, you can't always do that, because you're not, you know, you're writing a story and you can't necessarily create characters specifically just to help someone have a little bit more rounded acting. But when that's possible, I absolutely love seeing that, because people will surprise you. Like, when people expect actors to just fit in one little thing that they've done, that's insane. Like, so there's so many actors that are so talented, but they kind of get put in this one position, this one role repeatedly over and over, you know, and it's wild.
I fell in love with that back in film school when we were doing our final projects, and mm-hmm. I got kind of a reputation as a writer, and I could punch out a script pretty fast. And one thing I shot my future wife, that's where I met my wife, it was in school, and I was writing a project for the group, and it was kind of like, you know what, you know, we had like two guys and her, it was like two guys and a girl, and I was kind of like, I can, it's so easy to write for what you think they might do, and I was like, screw that. And I fell in love with writing for characters, you know, for cross type. Is like, mm-hmm. So she comes off as a sweet, innocent little girl. Definitely going to make her like a mean, nasty bitch. And yeah, he's a big muscle-bound jock guy. Make him like mentally deficient. You make him like slow, you know, like this. You know, and then really play him off cross-type. Then one guy was great at comedy. Make him super dramatic, you know, and see how those actors play with that. See how they run with those lines and how they, you know, how they deliver that character. I fucking love that shit. And I love it when directors give actors the opportunity to do that.
Yeah. And I think it's also, if we're going to talk the business side of things, it's just smart in that way also, because, you know, ultimately, you know, you're paying day rates, you're all that, but to get someone interested in your project, you know, if you're offering them the same thing they always do, it gets old eventually. Sure, everyone likes to work, but if you can give someone a reason to want to come and be that much more excited about it, you know, I mean, it doesn't hurt anything. It doesn't hurt the production, you know?
And to be that director, you know, he's like, oh, definitely want to work with him, because he's going to give you the opportunity to try and break new ground and do new things and do interesting stuff and try to really spread your wings a little bit as a performer, because it's what we're all looking for, is every opportunity.
Sure.
So leading up to, you broke ground yourself with, and I want to make sure I get this right, Fontaine and the Vengeful Nun Who Wouldn't Die.
Correct. Yes.
All right. So I sat down and watched this bad boy, and it's been a long time since I've seen a film that was like legitimately a love letter to the entirety of the exploitation, the whole span of it. Because you've got it all in there. You've got, I'd say you touch on virtually everything. You've got everything. You got blaxploitation. You've got Nazi exploitation. You've got fucking sexploitation. What really got me, Chanbara, is that you tied. I was like, holy shit. Like, he's run the full thing here. And I had to know. I was like, I was sitting here watching. I was putting it all together in this beautiful little, like, you know, gory ballet. And I was kind of like, of all those pieces, because you selected from so many and you wove them together so effortlessly. What were your inspirations there? Yeah, to dive into there and tell that kind of story.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you very much. I will forever view Fontaine as the movie that taught me how to make movies. You know, and it's not perfect. It's not a perfect film for sure. So there was a short film we made before it, and it's even less perfect. But so the long and short of it is there was a story I read about a person who was on a lot of drugs, and she was having visions, and she was very religious, very religious. I come from a Catholic background. I'm atheist now, but I have that background. My co-writer also comes from a Catholic background.
You don't say. I'm sorry.
No,
I didn't want to say there was a slant there. It's like, I think there's a message here. So, no.
but long story short, this person, and it's a sad story. She ended up, and this kind of would go back to the short film. It explains how Mary loses her eye. In the short film, Mary basically has a psychotic break and she rips her own eye out, right? And so that explains that. Well, in real life, this individual who was on tons of drugs and was like, her parents were very devout, like, you know, you go to church all the time. She, in front of her church, ended up ripping her own eyes out. And this is a true story. This is nothing I've written. Wow. This is a true story. She was on, like, you know, all the talk shows and stuff. And it's really sad. And it got me thinking about, you know, there's tons of stories, and you know, even Kill Bill, you know, anyone that's uninitiated with exploitation. Or even if I'm trying to tell someone who has no idea what, like, the easiest way for me to describe Fontaine is to say Kill Bill if they had no budget, you know? And the funny thing is that I get that is the easiest way, but the truth is somewhat a lot deeper than that, because like the influences I had were probably pretty similar to like Tarantino's influences, you know, like a lot of those exploitations from 60s and 70s.
Right.
You know, there's even some obviously there's some kung fu moments in
yes
Fontaine, you know. But now, we were lucky enough to have several people who really were, they did have black belts, so you know. Anyway, back to the question. Sorry, I get sidetracked.
No, it's okay, go. Yeah, because
yeah, so
there's so much going on in Fontaine, and
there is so much. There is so much.
It all comes together in this night, in this gory little tapestry, and I really enjoyed it. Because it never loses itself. You manage to keep the pace throughout, and that's what makes it the most entertaining. It's kind of like, because each one plays to the next scene, and I never found a moment where it middles. And when you're touching on that many different exploitation subgenres, it can get a little, it's kind of like, because where's the balance? And you found it. So
yeah. Well, thanks, man. I do absolutely appreciate it. There's a lot that I wish we could have done differently, but I mean, like, you know, the truth is that took us 9 months to shoot, and you know, everyone involved was volunteer. The whole production was volunteer. 9 months, we shot usually one day a week, sometimes 2 days a week. We were halfway done with production and COVID hit. So the lockdowns came on. So then we shut down for 3 months. And then we came back, and then we shot for another 3 months. And it is to date the most shoot days we've ever had on a film. Now, you know, we were newer to filmmaking. when you watch it, there's everything from someone running with a sword and chopping people down, like up to 7-8 people at a time being chopped down with a sword. And there's a chainsaw scene. And there's so much insanity that occurs in that film that you know, getting all that on screen, it's a lot. So making it all
a lovely little callback to Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS. I really love that.
Thank you.
I see what he did there. Very cool.
It was really, you know, the actor, I had worked with her a couple times before, and you know, I said, hey, you know, what can we do? What are you not okay doing? Do you want to show a nipple? Do you not want to show? Because, you know, like if someone's not comfortable with something, that's one thing. Like one thing that I'm very, very adamant about is safety. And that goes across the board with fights, with any kind of weapon use, anything sexual in nature or nudity. You know, those things all have to be discussed and planned in advance, you know. But sometimes an idea comes up on set and it's like, oh, that would be really, really sick and twisted, and I like it, but I'm not going to present it in front of everybody. You know, I'm going to present it me and the actor, and if they're okay with it, cool. So she was okay with the scene where she uses the blood on the torture table, and then she uses that as like a lubricant of sorts to masturbate. And she was fine with it. She was okay with that, you know? So I was like, okay, cool. It's a twisted movie, you know? And I think the Nazis got the worst of it, both of them. And I mean, the Nazis, they probably should, let's be honest.
They absolutely should. I do have one, okay, out of all the things that go down in that movie, and mm-hmm. all of the swordplay and all of the choreography and excellent choreography out of, and the name of them, just because you use the same group for Triple Xmas and the choreography group that did all the fight choreography. Logic Martial Arts. Thank you. Yes. I wanted to give them a shout out because I was like, oh, cool. You use the same people for the next film. That's awesome. Where did the stash box come from? Because I have to know.
The cross? Yes.
The cross? And I was like, please. Yeah. It was either custom made or you found that in some head shop in the middle of nowhere.
Okay. So I had one person that helped with art department, and his brother actually had it. And his brother, who was like 19 or whatever, was like using it for his stash. And he's like, hey, I brought something special for set today. And I was like, okay, what do you got? And he shows it to me. And I was like, you got to be fucking kidding me. I was like, this is amazing.
I think the only thing that is comparable was a big crucifix that you can 3D print that actually turns into a transformer that like opens up and turns into a big deal. Then it's a crucifix. I thought that was, but I was like, dude, and then it turns and it's upside down.
I
was like, that is amazing. I was like, please tell me. He had to have had that custom made, or somebody had that from some obscure location. I don't even remember where I bought it, man.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
No.
That's basically it. To circle back around to a couple things you said, Logic Martial Arts, it's really one man, Brian Davis. So Brian Davis played the master in Fontaine, and he is actually back as a supporting, almost lead, you know, right under lead, I would say, in Absolution. So, nice. And then of course he's one of those guys, again, I will continue. As I grow and do bigger and bigger projects, I will continue to work with the same people. And if that means we all have to go in and put more training in one place, or need to get certified for something, or, you know, once we dig into SAG, you know, if something is required for to work with SAG or something, I will be happy to put Brian through the additional training if it needs to happen, because I will keep working with the same people. He's been doing this for, I don't know. I mean, he's a black belt. He's been doing that forever, but he's been working on film for probably 6 or 7, 8 years. And he helped us with the short film, and, you know, then things just continued. First time I met him, we started talking movies right away, and we just kind of became good friends and kind of just went from there. There was something else that I was going to mention to you, kind of just as far as like being able to tell the story straight through and trying to keep it cohesive. There were a lot of things with that script that, you know, I don't like getting political, so I'm not going to get political, but I will say this. I'm a white straight dude, right? The characters in that film are, you know, gay women. Okay. So I made it a point to send the script off to a variety of people for feedback, you know, bisexual, gay, male, female, trans. And I got tons of feedback on that. Again, and this is kind of similar to Triple Xmas. while there's a lot of like over the top ridiculousness in Fontaine, there is actually a couple like messages if you're looking for that kind of thing. As far as if you look at nunsploitation, which a lot of people have no idea that's even a subgenre,
yeah,
but most nunsploitation has tons of nudity and lesbian sex.
Right.
The two leads in Fontaine have a kiss, and that is it. Now, there's some other nudity, but the one thing that we didn't exploit in Fontaine was that relationship, right? Now, in a film where everything else is pushed to 10 as far as being ridiculous or, I mean, maybe not even ridiculous, just exploitative, you know? That was the one thing we made sure not to, and that was my choice. I didn't want to push that aspect of it, you know? Triple Xmas is kind of similarly, you know, we pushed a lot of things, but there was also a very clear message, you know, just kind of even a little bit of satire with Santa in general, because he, you know, he was wronged, and because he was wronged, he feels that he can just like destroy everything around him. How many times have you seen that online? I mean, how many times have you seen one guy that's been wronged by one woman? And then all women are evil. Get over yourself, dude. You know, like, I mean, yeah, there's some evil women. There's tons of evil men, too. You know, it works. That's humans. I mean, like, that's how it works, you know, unfortunately.
And I like that you brought that up. And now I'm sitting there thinking about it. It's like, yeah, that did that. I apparently myself wasn't looking for it, but it does call back. There was a several years ago, there was a review done on basically like, exploitation films, sexploitation, grind, you know, a number of the grindhouse genres, and how
sure.
Typically, in retrospect, a lot of critics have said that anytime like lesbians or anytime like, you know, like women's sexuality or anything of that nature was placed on screen, that it came from a very misogynistic place. That the whole sure. point was, even though you're showcasing this, for the male pleasure.
Sure.
For guys to watch this and be like, oh yeah, well, you know, well, yeah, look at the girls making out, and that's not doing a service to either the minority it's representing or even the actors themselves who are trying to tell a story, because the intentionality is all wrong. And so that's what Grindhouse became known for back in the 60s and the 70s. And then, of course, those directors who want to go back and do a hallmark to that, they will remember that and pull back. It's not, you know, to use yeah. these people for, you know, it's not porn is the whole point. It's right. the whole point is right. to tell a particular story and use these particular images, which I'm glad that you did. Now that it's kind of clicking now that you brought it up, I was like, holy shit. And that very, very, very awesome.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I appreciate it. You know, at the same time, there's, you know, more so with Fontaine and Absolution, there's also a little bit of like me getting things out, you know, Fontaine, you know, the lead character, she's just a ball of fury. She's mad at the world, and her anger is so strong and overpowering, and it influences and corrupts her entire existence in a lot of ways. And man, I feel like most people, especially guys, but like I definitely was there at one point in my life where like anger was just a huge driving force, and it was just like, oh, and it eats you. It just eats you up. And I think that was something, if anything, that was the personal part of me that I was able to put on screen there, that a character could get so ate up and destroyed and just corrupted by anger itself, you know?
Right.
So with Absolution, it kind of more explores a little bit of making choices earlier in life, and then not making the best choice, and then years later still contending and dealing with those choices and just coming to terms with what happened and that you can't do anything to change it. And now you're here. And what do I do now? Kind of, you know? And then there's
I loved how that came through in the final sequence when, you know, you always get that opportunity with the bad guy, with the ultimate villain, is, you know, given their whole like thing about why they're justified, why they're doing what sure. they're doing, and this like that. And I loved, and I saw that kind of come out in that final speech where, you know, the new Fontaine is, I don't want to spoil too much for those who haven't seen it.
Sure.
For when she is giving the big thing, and she's talking I got to tell people her name is like Mary the Maniac Nun,
yeah.
which is probably the best names I've heard as for a heroine in a while. But there was a beautiful moment that you captured there. And I love that there was these nuanced moments, these very poignant moments that were, you know, throughout the film. And I love that because, and if you give my props to Mallory, because I'm watching the scene and all the things that Mallory has done going up to that point, that actress has done going up to this point, there's this moment she's having that conversation and everything that is coming out of the new, Fontaine's mouth, she recognizes as being as hallmarks of truth. She recognizes the truth there. And she does this magnificent job of internalizing that and realizing is like, okay, who am I fighting for? What am I fighting against? The goals are actually the same, but the methodologies are different. And then she has to she runs that gamut. And I fucking love how she does that.
Yeah.
And brings a level of depth that I don't think many people will expect. Given that there is nuance and depth to this, which I think is what should attract people to see it.
Yeah, I absolutely love that you're bringing some of these things up. And I there have been, I think, two or three total, right, people that have brought up little key things that I purposefully tried to incorporate in the film or did incorporate, and they noticed it. And so many people didn't notice these things. And if anything, they probably kind of were like, well, I wish there was more tits, you know, like that. I'm like, okay, I get that. I get that. So maybe Triple Xmas will be more their thing. And that
give
you
Triple Xmas.
You know,
we did a Fady Alvarez. Evil Dead was too loud. Well, then fine. Have one where no one fucking talks.
Right. No, you know, like even, back to Fontaine, like, you know, there were people that had issues with, and of course I get it. Like, sexual assault on screen is a hard thing to do. And then when you're shooting it in a fashion that is exploitative, and we pulled frames from Miss 45 for reference and for some sort of like guide on, I really do want to make this feel horrible and icky, you know, worse than normal, you know? And then to go where it does go, granted, not a lot of people saw Fontaine, so that might have been the saving grace of me not getting just attacked nonstop. There was one podcast that watched 30 minutes of it, turned it off, and then decided to record for an hour and 30 minutes. So they recorded an hour and 30 minute review on the 30 minutes they watched.
Oh, come on.
And I was like, that's cool. I never contacted them or anything. It was fine. You know, you don't have to like anything that I make. That's fine, or anything in general. But like, why would you record that long if you only watched 30 minutes of it?
Oh, this, I got nothing to say about this. Hour and a half later, 90 minutes later. Well, it's like, well, I guess that's all I have to say about that. Thanks, Chief. Appreciate it. That's just, you know, oh man, it's just freaking goofy. But I loved what, I absolutely loved what Mallory brought to that. What yeah, everybody had, you know, especially Ron Clower. Ron did a magnificent job. That everybody delivered everything they could. It was very, very, I thought it was good.
Yeah. So thank you. And you know, it was very, 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 that took 2 years from start to finish, not including the writing. You know, like from production to finished product. And wow, you know, I'll be honest with you, at the end of that, you know, if you'd have asked me towards the end of that, if I would have been like ready to go make another film, I would have probably said no, because it took a lot out of me. I pushed myself in ways that, you know, now I'm better at, I've been a little better at finding that balance, which I think is something that it takes a film or two or three to really realize that you can't maintain that level of, you can't maintain that level of just 110%. And, you know, and like, you know, to make that film, I had to cash out everything I had. I sold a vehicle, everything, you know, the little bit of retirement that I had, you know, like $15,000 in retirement, gone. You know, I had an old Nintendo system with like 40 games, you know, it was like $500, gone, you know, like anything I had access to. I was kind of transitioning out of a business, and like all those tools, like $3,000, gone, you know, all into the movie, you know. And that was also considering that everyone except for like sound design and post and the Blu-rays and everything, everyone else volunteered their time. There was a little bit of makeup costs and prosthetics, that kind of stuff is expected. But you know, like I put everything I had in every way into that film, and it was such a cathartic moment once it was done. And we did a screening. The goal for that one was to do a screening at a drive-in. And we did. We did our, nice. I mean, like, cause it's a drive-in movie.
Hell yes. Yeah. This yeah. classic. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
oh, that's so cool. So, and going off of that, going off of the madcap insanity that is that film and the sheer just joy of going back and getting, you know, watching a love letter to all those old school movies that, you know, stuff that my uncle showed me when I was growing up. He probably should not have shown me. Right. But, I still can't get over it. I fucking love that you touched on Ilsa. And then I was like, there's a nice little throw in there. I was like, ah, yes, I need my dominatrix Nazi Fräuleins. I really do.
One really, really, really quick side note. The guy who played the surgeon, he is the lead in Absolution. He's the lead. Nice. So I absolutely loved working with him, John Mefford. And he is so talented. The man has acted at now probably close to 45 years. And that was his first film was Fontaine. He had just done all theater. And he is he's one of the best actors I've ever worked with. And that's not hyperbole. He is fantastic. I think theater actors are more often than not just amazing. Sometimes you have to pull them back a bit.
We do. That's play okay. Big.
That's okay. Just, I feel like it's a little easier to pull people back a little bit than to try to coax them into being bigger.
Yeah.
You know, because
that was the first thing. Yeah, coming out of KD, like all of my background's theater experience, going all the way back to elementary school, and then coming all the way. Then I went to film school, and I went to theater, and you know, I got my. I was like, okay, now I'm ready to go. First time I found myself on a film set. Everybody, like, I think I did the scene, and someone looked at me like he was like, "Dude, man, bring it down a little bit." It's like he's like, "What are you talking about?" It's like, "You are so big, and the camera is like, but the camera's up there." It's like, "No, dude, it's like right here. It's like here. You look like this." And I was like, "Oh shit, yeah." Rein it in. So yeah. a little more nuance there, Chief. You're not trying to hit the cats in the you know, on the mezzanine. It's that's not how far it is.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Love it. Now, but so you did Absolution, but that hasn't been released yet. And right. I know you gave a little bit of information about that, so we're going to wait for that to come out. But then you dropped Triple Xmas. Now, I was aware of Triple Xmas from the social media push I saw coming out of that. I was like, that looks really, really interesting. And had an opportunity to watch it via the website it's on that you are currently hosting it via. So I got a chance to watch it there. And
New Village Video. Yeah.
New Village Video. And... okay, so I got to ask.
Okay.
You know, and it's got all the lovely, you know, like exploitation, grindhouse stuff that you'd expect. There's like a lot of bloodletting, a lot of, you know, like say, lots of nudity, lots of exploitation. Now, compared to Fontaine, giving you, you're kind of like fresh in there. You have the experience under your belt now. Now you're going after one. I think this is a little bit more of a complex shoot. Given, you know, I know there's a lot of choreography, but this one, you know, you're tighter quarters. There's a lot more movement. There's a lot more camera angles that's going on. And I'm curious. But essentially, and not to spoil too much, but you're essentially doing a slasher, you know, it's not a porn, but it's a slasher on a porn set. And given the actors and what's going on and what you're telling, did that prevent, I have to ask, did that present any unique challenges you weren't expecting going into a film like this?
Right. So the one thing that, you know, the majority of the actors involved that did the sex scenes, not all of them, but most of them have done sex work of some form in the past, be it OnlyFans or Dolly Lee was in the industry with regards to like she did porn for a long time. Julie. And so she, you know, she Google her, just not in the open, you know, not your office, but so. Again, because of that, I did make sure to get notes from these individuals because I wanted to make sure that nothing was like too crazy with regard to like representation of the sex workers themselves. As far as like unique challenges, I think the one that I was most nervous about was the big scene where it's like an orgy, essentially. It's a group sex scene that turns into a bloodbath.
Right.
And I was nervous about that from the get-go. But if you took a look at like the original script and you saw what the original script was, or if you could get into my head, or if you saw the storyboards and you saw what was wanted versus sometimes what ended up on camera, you would realize that like indie film is about being able to get as much as you can that's in your head in the frame. And there's times where there's these beautiful images you have in your head that you want to get across and you want to be able to accomplish. And it's just not possible. It's just not possible. Not with the money you have or not with the time. We had 10 full days to shoot this entire film. 10 days, 9 of which were back to back, back to back. And, you know, I was on set usually 16 hours, 18 hours out of the day. And none of the actors worked those long of hours. I made sure of that. But, you know, like it was really tough on the crew, especially because a lot of them were around for a very long time. I think logistically it was really hard scheduling. I think that's honestly the biggest challenge was scheduling actors that were only going to be there 3 or 4 days. And then making sure to get the shots that we needed that would match later on for certain cuts, or if we needed to show that someone was dead and they haven't been on set for 2 or 3 days, but we're shooting the next scene and we need to show that they're still dead, like getting those things. Those were the real challenges. You know, as far as like the sex scenes, we ordered C-strings. You know, we did not have an intimacy coordinator. We just didn't have the funds for it. I did take the time to talk to everyone about what they were and were not comfortable with. And some people weren't comfortable with certain things. So we adjusted. I rewrote some things a little bit because ultimately it comes down to making sure that, you know, if you're on my set and you're okay with this, but not that, sometimes it's the weirdest small thing that someone doesn't want to do, but it's really not weird if they're not comfortable doing it. It's their feelings are legitimate and you have to understand. You have to kind of come to them just as a human to human and break down, well, what about this? You know, is it okay if we try it this way instead? You know, where's the line? What do you not want to do? Making sure that's 1000% crystal clear. And then also, you know, obviously we weren't making a porn, so no skin to skin contact in the genitalia area is pretty important, you know? Yeah, I mean, like, those are the things that really, most of those things have to be discussed and decided way before you ever get on set. Right. Sometimes when you're on set, things do have to change a bit, and that's when everything has to halt, and you have to just have that conversation. Yeah, I mean, like, there's a moment where two girls are taking a bath, and they get sprayed with tons of blood. You know, Dolly was unbelievably awesome about just standing around soaked in blood, completely naked for 20 minutes. And she would jump in and do a small little, you know, a shot or two. And then we would need her to pause so we could keep shooting the rest of the scene. And then we'd jump back and finish her scene. But that meant she was standing around, you know, and I gave her the option. Do you want to go clean up and then we'll shoot the rest of it in an hour or two? But that means we have to mash this blood completely how it is now. So we have to soak you again from chest down, essentially, with blood. You know, those definitely were challenging. But everyone was so good about just rolling with it. Most people, you know, they understood what indie film is about, that it's not always fun. And it really isn't always fun. That's always what my goal is for us to create a unique story and have fun on set. But, you know, when I'm on set for 16 or maybe sometimes 18 hours straight, it's not fun sometimes when I'm, you know, hour 16 or 18. And then I have, you know, an hour drive back and then back again and then 3 or 4 hours sleep. And there were a few times where I had to go to work for a few hours in between, you know, so it's like, you know, it's hard to keep things fun when that's kind of, but yeah, I think as far as the sex scenes, just making sure everyone planned out and discussed and everyone was okay with everything with regards to what was going on in that shot. You know, if someone's on top, someone's not on top, where body parts are, where faces are, hands are, you know, that all just has to be kind of carefully planned and discussed in advance. You know, you have to do it with the actors individually. Then they have to talk about it. Then we all get together. So it's a lot of time, you know?
Right. We constantly talk about on the show how planning is paramount in virtually everything that you're doing. When things aren't planned out well, it comes across in the screen in the worst possible ways. We
for sure
constantly pointing that out a lot. It's kind of like, you see where, you know, the director didn't really, you know, he tried to go into this a little bit, you know, kind of like, let's just do it. Let's just knock it out. And you know, then you end up wasting money, and then, you know, you wind up screwing yourself in the long run. Now, the I will say the wonderful addition of Felissa Rose to Triple Xmas. As I was following along through the social media push and was picking up little updates here and there, the process of I was kind of curious myself. The process of getting Felissa attached to the picture, was there any difficulty there, or did it just kind of like fall that way, or was that planned from the very beginning?
We originally had actually reached out to Darcy from Joe Bob. I had an associate producer, a guy who came on, and he had her direct phone number contact. And normally I wouldn't go that direction, but he said that he had on good authority that she was okay with me contacting her and just to relay that I knew another individual. And so I talked to her briefly about it. It just nothing ever panned out in that regard. And, you know, for whatever reason, and that's fine. You know, she's busy. Things happen, you know.
Right.
And someone said they knew Felissa. And obviously, I mean, I had never met Felissa before Triple Xmas. And I had heard she was the biggest sweetheart in the world. And like, that's an understatement. She is a fantastic, like she's actually coming into St. Louis this next weekend, and we're going to have dinner and we're going to go out to watch Sleepaway Camp. She's going to do like a live thing with it. So she's just amazing. Going back to once you meet someone, you work with them, she is someone that I want to work with a lot more in the future. And I really want to be able to give her roles that maybe she isn't always offered, you know, because I do feel like, you know, like I don't know if I've ever seen her in a comedy. Now, I know she does a lot of indie film, but like one day if I do a comedy, I would want to find a role for her right off the bat, because you know what, like, I've never seen that. And I think that would be fun, you know, and it'd be fun to work in that regard. And she is funny.
It'd be a nice breakaway.
Just doing something different. But so really I knew someone that had worked with her, and because I had talked to probably about 80 different indie filmmakers, and she does do a lot of indie film. I had reached out to a couple of them, and you know, they kind of made the connection for me. But long story short, if you want anyone, it doesn't matter who you want. If you want someone, if you go to IMDb Pro and you look up their agent, you can email them and have contact with their agent. Now, that doesn't mean it's always going to work out. You know, you may not be able to afford their day rate, you know.
That's true.
You know, I was in contact with a couple names that everyone knows for the Elf to begin with. But just, you know, when it comes down to day rates and everything, I was like, okay, understandable. You were in Pirates of the Caribbean. I get it. It's not happening. Cool. Oh, you want more if there's stunts? Okay, cool. This conversation is over. Thank you for even emailing me back. I get it. We didn't have the resources. I overstepped my... Yeah, okay. But, you know, yeah, it's one of those things. Like, IMDb Pro is just, you know, $20 a month, and you can get everyone's agent's name. And some people have five different agents, or they have different agents for different things. And reaching out to them, you better have a good script. You know, you better be able to have what their day rate is. And if you don't know their day rate, you can ask it, or you can reach around and ask other indie filmmakers who've worked with them. You know, sometimes they'll share that information, you know, that way you're not looking like a complete idiot. If you're, you know, asking someone to come on set for one day and their day rate's $20,000 and that's the budget of your entire film, you know,
that is freaking cool. Now going ahead. So where we have, Atonement to look forward to coming out here pretty soon.
Yeah, Absolution.
Absolution. No. Coming out, you think in 2024 or?
Yeah. Fall or winter. So it was already halfway cut when I kind of took a little bit of a detour with Triple Xmas. So it's I haven't got back to it just yet. I made a promise that I would take a couple weeks off, and I'm kind of still in that right now. But I expect to get back into editing that. So I'll kind of get back into that and then score, and there's some visual effects work that needs to be done.
Nice.
And I've been reaching out to people that, you know, do, you know, they're musicians. So, but yeah, so I fall, winter. Yeah.
Nice.
Should be done.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Going forward after that, I mean, you said you're working on a bunch of different stuff. Any idea or anything you could talk about, or you keep kind of play things close to the chest?
Yeah. I mean, like, well, I mean, the thing is I can talk about a little bit of all of them, but I'm not 100% sure which one we're going to go with just yet. Okay. I'm currently writing a giallo film, mm-hmm. which is, Yeah, I mean, it's a My Blade Is Your Salvation is the name of that one. It's very nice. Early. I have a lot of the story in my head and a lot of how I want the story to go, but it's not. It's very, very early on. I have another film called Prom Night Massacre, and that would be kind of set in the 80s and very much. Yeah, I mean, like it's not a slasher film, believe it or not. It's more of girls on their way to prom, their car, you know, they take the wrong exit, and then it's kind of a survival of these teenagers versus this gang. So it's not a slasher film at all.
Nice.
Yeah. You know, again, both of these films require bigger budgets than we've ever worked with, for sure. And then the other film doesn't even necessarily have a title yet, but my co-writer Louis Otero, who co-wrote Triple Xmas and he co-wrote Fontaine, he's writing one on his own, and it's kind of like an A24 Midsommar meets Demons. So it's so, you know, I read the first third of that script, and I'll be honest with you, I read a lot of scripts, and you know, sometimes it's hard to get excited. I read the first third, and you know, I am so pumped to read the next portion of it, because, and like, what more could you want from a reader than that? You know, if you handed me 30 pages and I said, okay, well, where's the 31st page? Come on. Why are you holding out? You know? And that's what I told him. I said, man, I couldn't give you a better compliment than this. Like, the characters are being developed. I love, you know, I mean, sure, it's first draft, but like, wow, this is. So no matter what project is next, I do know that there will be some level of crowdfunding, more than likely. There will be private equity being brought in. And I do believe we're probably going to try to go SAG on this next one. Nice. And probably make use of tax credits. Missouri just bring back tax credits for filmmakers. If Missouri can't offer us an incentive to shoot here, then I will go to another state and shoot. We've shot everything.
Oklahoma does cash rebates.
Oh, well, that's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah, because we recently found out through the Oklahoma Film and Music, the Oklahoma Film and Music Program Office, and yeah, of course the Cherokee Film and Music Office as well, and they do the same thing. Only they do cash rebates instead of tax incentives.
Interesting. So
that's
interesting. You know, like, even I spoke to an indie filmmaker who is working at indie film at a completely different level. He's working in, like, his last film he just made was like between $600,000 and $700,000, right? Huge gap between what I've been doing. But just talking to him and talking about how tax incentives can help you to secure additional funding, because if I'm talking to you and you say, hey James, I can give you $100,000 for this film, but I want first position tax credit, you know, that means your investment is guaranteed through the state, because as long as we hit that amount, then the state will eventually give back the tax credit. If it's in the contracts that it's guaranteed back to you because you're first position. So that is the starting point for me to say, well, we've already raised $100,000 through JL. JL is a pretty well-known guy. He's a good producer. And so do you want to come on? Do you want to give me $50,000 to help make this film also? You know, I can't negotiate first position anymore. I wouldn't bring that up in negotiations, but you see what I'm saying? Like, I never would have thought of that, but now I have that knowledge and I'm just going to keep. So that's kind of what this year is me learning and making moves, and probably honestly bringing on a producer that has experience working with SAG, and maybe even a producer that understands fundraising a little bit better. I'm not afraid to do the dirty work and really get in there, but I also know that I need support from people that have that experience already, not people that are growing up through the industry with me. Like, it'll help to have some people that are just up a little higher, and then, you know, like, I can kind of rise up to their their level with any, that's the goal, you know? So yeah.
Any chance of possibly returning to the Fontaine universe with that teaser we got in the credits?
You know, I absolutely want to return to that universe. I even joked that there could be my co-writer commissioned someone to do an art piece of Santa versus Mary.
Nice.
which I actually have sitting back here. He got it for me for Christmas, and it has Santa like with a hammer versus Mary with her sword and her eye patch. Nice. And you know, like, so I made a joke that you know, I kind of wanted to do this, like, the space pirate idea, very cheesy machismo guy, and he goes through a black hole and encounters Mary, and then he gets sucked in, and it's this whole, like, you know, I don't know. I we have had ideas, we've had discussions on it. I think that no matter what the next film we make, I want 2 to 5 times minimum the budget of what I've had in my last few films. I need more resources, and I need, yeah, I mean, so even like Fontaine sequel, I would want quite a bit more money, because it's just, yeah, it's so much. And I want to make sure, I'm at the place now where I want to make sure every single person on set is being paid. And, yeah, you know, that's hard to do. You know, I mean,
definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I would be so down. I would pay to see that in a heartbeat, you know, Mallory versus Drew, and yeah, to have them go to town. I could just see that. He's got to have like a fucking candy cane sword or some shit like that. Yeah. It's got to be brilliant. Yeah. The two of them. I'm spitballing, but I think that would be fucking,
no,
awesome.
Yeah, yeah, that, yeah, would
be off the hook. All right. So in the future, I mean, so many projects coming along and a lot of things, you know, any particular goals, like special things that you would like to do personally or professionally going forward, says maybe sometime in the future?
Yeah, yeah.
People you want to work with, or?
You know, long term, this is completely unrelated to film, but long term, I want to have a farm with my girlfriend and rescue dogs. And I know that's unrelated, nice, to filmmaking, but I think that's going to be my way of giving back in this life, maybe in some capacity. With regards to like who I would want to work with, or I mean, like, man, like, you know, okay, Nick Cage. I mean, why wouldn't I? Let's be honest. Come on. Nick Cage would be fantastic. There's a lot of actors that I think are amazing actors, but they often are played second. And I would want to work with them mostly, probably over lead actors, because I feel like, again, that would give them the opportunity to do something where they're a lead role. And again, it also could attract someone to my project that may not necessarily always be attracted to like this kind of project. But I mean, Nick Cage, of course, Nick Cage. There's tons of actors out there that I'd love to work with for sure.
I'm excited. He's got a new one coming out here soon called Long Legs. Have you heard about it?
I heard about it. I haven't seen a trailer.
He plays a serial killer who's being tracked down by the hero. But yeah, apparently it's, you know, if you're familiar with it, because you know Mandy and you know Color of Space. And of course, yeah, you know, I thought his turn in the movie Pig, I thought it was absolutely phenomenal.
It was great. It wasn't what I was expecting, but it was exactly fantastic.
And, yeah, but apparently Long Legs, he kind of like goes for broke in that direction again. Yeah, kind of like dark, but not in, but with a kind of like manic underlying, but not the extreme that we're kind of used to. Not the Cage rage, but I'm really looking forward to that one. That one's getting some interesting buzz around it. So,
have you seen his film? I forgot the Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
Yes, him and Pascal. Yes,
yeah, Pedro Pascal. First of all, Pedro looking up at him, smiling in the car. If I saw that man in real life, I might be arrested only because I would run up and want to give him the biggest hug. Like, that smile makes me just want to hug him. Like,
I saw that. I knew of the movie and I hadn't seen it yet, but then I saw the meme and I saw it with Pedro driving and just the, I have to see this movie because Pedro Pascal is just, an incredible talent. I love everything
for sure,
he does.
For sure.
Especially, I mean, if you haven't seen the SNL sketch where he plays Mario in a kind of Last of Us parody of like a Mario Kart parody of Last of Us.
Yeah.
That right there sells it, you know, every time. So, but this has been,
Oh, I was going to say one other real quick. Paul Giamatti, I think people sleep on that man, and he is such a national treasure. I mean, he just won a Golden Globe, so we're not shooting for the stars here or anything. But
did you see that picture that somebody took? It was like, hey, he was like, send that figure when you're at the In and Out. Yes. And I was like, holy shit, it's Paul Giamatti. It's like,
that made me want to work with that man that much more. I'm going to be honest with you.
I was like, oh man, just still, it was like, yep, when you're at the In and Out during Golden Globes, there's Paul.
Yeah. 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 That's amazing. No, yeah, it's fantastic. Fantastic. So, but cool.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh man. Yeah, this has been an absolute blast. So many cool things. And just to let everybody know out there, if you haven't checked it out yet, for all those listening, Fontaine and the Vengeful Nun Who Wouldn't Die is currently available to watch on Tubi. So go and check that out as soon as you can. And if you pop on over to the website, I want to make sure that I get it right. because I need to. I actually had it pulled up right here to newvillagevideo.com. Newvillagevideo.com. You can stream Triple Xmas, or you can go to, make sure I get this one right as well, to monsterkidfilms.com if you would like to get a physical copy of it to add or to just do pre-orders on those.
Yeah, right now we're basically, I was waiting for more to come in. I had so many I had to ship out. Finally, I'm about to catch up. But yeah, it's about 7 to 10 days out. So when you order, it'll be shipped in about a week. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nice. And you can get a physical Blu-ray copy of Triple Xmas and a Fontaine and the Vengeful Nun Who Wouldn't Die. Awesome, awesome stuff. And of course, we have Absolution to look forward to, which hopefully it will be out winter this year. Yeah, winter this year.
Sure.
So much amazing stuff. So James, thank you so much for hanging out with us.
Thank you. It was fun, man.
And all this super fun stuff. And I cannot wait to see what you have coming out next. So, you know, thank you very much.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Had a lot of fun.
Awesome. And to everybody listening out there, thank you so much for being a part of another episode of the Week in Horror Front Row series. We've been sitting here with writer, director, and extraordinary creative talent, James Dean. Can't wait to see what he has coming up next. If you want to, you can follow him on the socials. We're going to have those listed in the description, as well as check out those websites where you can pick up the physical copies of his products. And of course, Tubi. And of course, at, I totally was going to
NewVillageVideo.com.
NewVillageVideo.com. Awesome. I have been JL, I've been your host. We will see you all next month. And as always, stay scared.
That's the best time.